Like I said, my name is Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 20th of 1993, and my job tonight is to tell you a little bit about what my life used to be like, what happened, and what my life is like now. And it took me a long while to get to these rooms, I'll try to talk a little bit about that. I'm one of those that kind of believes that I was an alcoholic from the time that I was born, because I had a lot of feelings. I'm a feeling-driven person, but I'm also a thinker, just overly thinking things. And I can remember some feelings that I would have. I mean, in my earliest recollections as a child, in school was just painful for me. I was a very good student. I'm not saying I was a brain, but I mean, I really got along very well in school, academically, but socially, I was just very inept and just painfully shy. And I can remember when the teacher would call on me and stuff, I would know the answer, but I would just get so choked up, like, oh my God, I'm put on the spot, and I just couldn't get the answer out, and my face would just get as red as can be, and then I'd finally bark it out, and, you know, meanwhile, I just was just so self-conscious that it just, you know, I couldn't think of anything else, and I was thinking, God, I just sounded so stupid, or, you know, I mean, it would just be like, you know, Chris Farley on Saturday Night Live, where he just pull his hair out. I mean, I don't know if y'all ever saw that skit, but anyway, I just feel like always second guessing myself, and just like I said, painfully shy and painfully aware of just being so, feeling so inept, that carried with me through. It still carries with me sometimes, not the ineptness so much, but just the painfully shy part. But I know that that's where God can really shine through, because even tonight sharing my story, I'm not nervous really, but you'd think I would be because of how I was, you know, how I was my whole life, just very, very scared of life and scared of people. I forgot to say my prayer. I have to say it because I have a little daily devotional that I read. It's Mother Teresa, and I just love her, but my mom, I forgot to bring it with me, so my mom, we had to call her on the way down, and my husband was like jotting it down, and so if I don't say it, it'll be just, you know. But it's a very beautiful prayer. It's from Cardinal Newman, and it says, God, shine through me and be so in me that every soul I come in contact with may feel your presence in my soul. Let them look up and see no longer me, but only you, O God. Stay with me, then I shall begin to shine as you do, so to shine as to be a light to others. Let me thus praise you in the way you love best, by shining on those around me. Amen. And I just, that's what my job is to do tonight, is to let God just shine through me, because, like I say, I mean, I'm not a professional speaker. I'm just a student of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to stay sober. And anyway, so let me get back to where I came from. Like I said, you know, so by the time I was 13, feeling all these icky feelings, and it, you know, I mean, my upbringing was very, very great. I mean, my parents, they're wonderful people. They sacrificed so much for me. I have an older sister and a younger brother, and I was always kind of jealous of both of them, even though there was no reason to. Now I see that, but back then it was just, you know, I was very jealous of them, and I felt like my sister was very popular, and I felt like my brother was very good in sports, and then there's Liz, you know. And but that's, you know, I mean, that was just all in my mind. And that's why, again, this is all before I started drinking, so I know that the illness of alcoholism centers in my mind, and I didn't know that back then, but I know that now, that I was an overthinker and thought too much and felt too much. And anyway, so by the time I'm 13, you know, I'm just kind of a person that was just kind of hanging around with the outcast at school, and I started smoking cigarettes. You know, I wanted to fit in somewhere, and I knew I didn't fit in with the cheerleader type, and I knew I didn't want to run around with the studious type, or the jocks and the football players and all that stuff. So I found my niche with what they called back then was the freaks, and they were the ones in the smoking area. You know, smoking cigarettes and stuff like that. And they just kind of accepted you. I mean, you didn't have to, there was no criteria, you just were accepted, you know? And I liked those kind of people that that weren't judgmental. And of course, smoking led to other things. I remember I discovered my first drink at a party I'd gone to at the end of the eighth grade when I was 13. And I had gone, we had a foreign exchange student with us, at, you know, I asked my mom if I could go to this party, and she said, okay. She says, but you have to take this girl with me, with you. And I said, Mom, I don't want to, because then that I felt like it, that would make me stick out like a sore thumb. I don't want to take her. And she says, well, that's the only way you're going to be able to go. And I knew that the guy I liked was going to be there, but he didn't know that I liked him. But, you know, in my mind, I had already walked down the aisle with this guy, you know. But anyway, so I said, all right, she can go. And so she went with me. And the guy that I liked and a friend of mine and another guy were kind of standing outside that part, the house. And they said, hey, why don't you stay here with us and go and drink some beer with us? And I was like, oh, gosh. And I was thinking, what am I going to do with her, you know? And so I told her, I said, you go on in. And she did not know any English or anything. I said, you go on in. And I'll be in a few minutes, and you just, you know, mingle with the people or whatever. She had no idea what I was saying, just kind of doing the sign language, pushing her in. And she went in, and I went out with those other people, with the other three, and we had a couple beers. I remember I only had probably a couple, maybe three beers that night. And I remember I was very nervous to be around that guy that I liked that didn't know that I liked him. And I was very nervous and stuff, but when I had those couple beers, I remember all of a sudden just this magic kind of went over me, and it was just like, wow, you know? And then I was able to talk to him. I was kind of funny with him, you know? I mean, just kind of joking and stuff like that. I was just, you know, and that's what the big book says, is that's what it does for us, is drinking, you know, we like the sense of ease and comfort that comes from drinking, and it comes at once. I didn't have to wait like 2 weeks after I took a drink and say, wow, when is that going to kick in? I mean, I started feeling something different immediately. And I didn't get rip roaring that night. I just, you know, I remember though the feelings that came from those couple beers, and I was like, man, this is kind of cool, because it didn't make me feel better then. It just kind of brought me up to the level where I wanted to be, where everybody else was, and you know, so after the effects of alcohol wore off, you know, I wanted to get that feeling again. I wanted to recapture that. I was never a daily drinker, even up to when my drinking had progressed. I never was a daily drinker up until the time I stopped drinking. But I tell you what, when I was, you know, after I had that first experience with alcohol, I wanted to find it again and again and again and again. And I started lying from that first time. I mean, my mom was asking me about the party, and, you know, here I was, very selfish and dishonest, you know, even from that party. And, you know, but the lying just continued from there. I mean, just the deceit, lying to myself, lying to everybody else. But it had started, you know, from that first time I drank. You know, like I said, you know, when you're 13, 14 years old, it's kind of hard to get it. So, you know, I babysat a lot, and I would raid their liquor cabinets or their pill cabinets or, you know, whatever. You know, just anything that would alter my state of mind. I got into other stuff very quickly also. But drinking was always the constant, and I loved it. I loved it. And if I could still drink now and without the consequences, hell, I'd still be doing it. But see, drinking took me down big time. And so what happened was I got into my, you know, well, let me tell you, just right after, right before high school was out, I'd gone to a private school. In fact, I just went and spoke to them about 3 weeks ago. I was able to go back on the premises of that school and talk about alcoholism, and that was such a treat for me to do, because I'd never been back on their grounds in what, 25, 30 years or whatever since I had left that school. I didn't leave on good terms with the school. They just didn't invite me back for the 11th grade. It was a private school, and I was glad I was out of there at that time. But you know what? Going back and seeing that school a few weeks ago, it was like, you know, that would have been a great education for me, you know. But I blew it. I blew it. At 17, I blew it. And because of my drinking and I was not applying myself anymore. And but to have that privilege to go back was really, really a treat for me and kind of healing for me. But anyway, so I met on my own even before high school was out, because my parents had gotten sick and tired of me. I mean, like I said, I started drinking when I was 13, and my sister was kind of doing the same deal as far as going out and not coming home and just getting drunk at the wrong moments. And my mom's mom was very ill, and she was dealing with that. And yeah, I didn't care. I mean, I cared, but drinking just was more important, and running with the crowd and the machine gun people and, you know, just people were kind of freaky that I was running with, and the more freakier they were, the better it was. The more bad they were, the more I was attracted to them. And I think that's part of my alcoholism as far as the living on the edge type thing. I just really thrived on that. And the sicker it was and the scarier it was and the more socially unacceptable it was, the more I was attracted to it. And I lived that way for many years. And the people that I was running with were, like I said, they were equally as attracted to that kind of stuff as I was. And so I started getting into trouble with the law, you know. And I always tell people that, you know, I couldn't abide by the rules at my family's house. And so they kind of invited me to either start abiding by the rules or get out. And I got out at 17. I wasn't even out of high school. Because I thought, you know, I don't need y'all telling me what to do. I always rebelled against authority. But I was very compliant with the outside world. It was just with my family that I was just so disrespectful and very defiant with them. And because here was this painfully shy girl that, you know, I wanted the world to accept me. But at home, I was just this, you know, this nightmare. But I got out on my own. And I remember living in, this was in Marietta, and this place was very undesirable. But I didn't care. I had roaches, you know, swarm. You'd be sitting there watching TV, and all of a sudden these roaches would be crawling on you. But I didn't care. I had my freedom. And that's all I wanted was freedom. I don't want anybody telling me what to do. And I lived there for a while until my money ran out because I had a little bit of a savings account. And I wasn't working. I mean, hell, you know. But when my money ran out, just like Bill Wilson says in his story, in our big book, you know, we make a host of fair weather friends. And that's exactly what I was making was I also was a fair weather friend. But the people I was running with when everything was going well and when I had something to contribute, hey, there they are, you know, and I was the same way. But the minute the chips are down, you're in jail, you're, you know, whatever, they're nowhere to be found. But I was making a host of those kind of people. And again, just running with really sick people. And I was just equally as sick. I can't say that they were any sicker than I was, but birds of a feather will flock together. You know, society will, you know, they just won't accept people. I mean, you know, the stuff I was doing, they were, you know, that's when they talk about we're socially maladjusted to life. And I definitely was doing a lot of things that were socially, you know, maladjusted. But anyway, as a result, I started getting in trouble with the law. I started getting some DUIs I remember the first time I got my first DUI, I remember I called my parents, you know. I mean, hell, you know, I mean, I'm not going to call the fair weather friends. I mean, hell, we couldn't even, you know, string together five nickels together, you know. But so my parents, they did come and get me, and I will never forget the way that they looked, the look on their faces when I saw them. And my mom was just so discouraged and so disgusted and disappointed. But I felt that way, too. And she said, you know what, if this ever happens again, don't call us because your father and I will not come and get you. And to you know, when the big book talks about incomprehensible demoralization, I mean, I don't know if you've all ever been in jail before, but to go through the process of being in jail, I mean, it was not prison, but it was jail. But still, I mean, it's just degrading, you know. And I was looking around because the more I sobered up in there, I'm thinking, how did I get here? You know, I mean, I knew how I got there, but I mean, it's just like, my gosh, you know, I mean, how did this happen? I mean, and so when my mom said that, I looked at her with so much sincerity. I said, this is never going to happen again. Don't worry about this. I mean, I've learned my lesson, you know, and I guess the lesson I learned was I'm not going to call them again when that happens again. You know, that's the lesson I learned at that time. But anyway, so in my I was able to always kind of get some good jobs and my alcoholism took me, like I said, it robbed me of any kind of education as far as going to college. I mean I always put a feather in my cap when I was in my sicker days thinking, you know, because my mom and dad said, you know, we'll pay for you to go to college. And I was like, pay for me to go to college? I mean, I'm not going to waste y'all's money. I mean, I knew it was just going to be just, you know, I would never get through it, so why even start? So, I mean, always thinking, you know, oh, look how selfless I was by even telling them, you know, oh, we're not going to waste the money on this because I know it's just going to be one big party. But anyway, so it robbed me of my education. But I was able to always get some good jobs. But then I started, as a result of me getting in trouble with the law so much, I thought, you know, I need some more allies here. So I started working in law firms. And they were able to help me, but they still had to charge me and stuff. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, getting the legal, you know, assistance for free. But anyway, but I have to say that the last law firm I worked at, you know, I mean, my life was pretty much in shambles. I remember when I got this job, it almost doubled my salary from my other jobs. And I remember walking around the block with my sister, and she said, you know what? Because I was just so excited. I was like, man, I'm going to get this job. I know I've got it in the bag. And she said, you know what? She said, if you keep drinking the way you're drinking, though, you're not going to be able to keep this job. And again, with utmost sincerity, I said, I'm not gonna blow this, you know, just like with my mom and dad. This is never gonna happen again. And I got the job, and I was so grateful, and I was almost, got it. And almost a year later, I almost lost it because of my drinking. I would always get it when I would start a new job. See, I was not one of those that did the geographical cure, although I did do some geographical stuff, but. I was more of those that would kind of switch around with jobs because I would get paranoid that they were going to fire me because I wasn't coming in or I was coming in late or whatever. And so I would just kind of go to another job. And I, like I said, they were really good jobs. And these people kind of kept me employed way longer than what I should have been employed. But then I would just go move on to someone else. And when I got this job that I had, this last job, like I said, it kind of caught up with me quicker than I could realize. I would always give 200% when I first started a job. I would always get in there and look how good I am. Man, I can work these people under the table, you know. But then I would start to prove myself. But then I would start getting going back to my old tricks again of not coming in, you know, and said, damn, I got this terrible flu, man. I don't know. And see, I would call in sick. And the thing of it was is sometimes I wouldn't call in because I wouldn't come to until maybe like 11 or 12 that morning. And I'm supposed to be at work at like 8:30. And I would just be, I mean, my mom came over a couple times because they would call. She was like on my emergency contact information. And we didn't have cell phones and all that back then. So she would come over and you know, try to wake me up. And if I was passed out, there was no waking me up. I mean, it was just until I was coming to, there was no coming to. And I remember she would beat on my door, and you know, she'd say, "My God, work is calling. What's going on?" And you know, I would just be mortified because I mean, it's hard to kind of. I was always a fast thinker, and I would always have an answer, but sometimes I couldn't come up with an answer because when you're so fogged up and feeling like crap physically, it's just kind of hard to come up with those answers when you need them. And you know, plus I'm sure I reeked like alcohol and stuff like that when I'd open the door. And she would just be, you know, again, just that feeling, that look of disgust and disappointment. And I just, you know, I mean, I knew that what I was doing was not right. I mean, I knew that, I mean, I had a lot of potential. And here I was in my late 20s, early 30s, you know, still doing stuff that I was doing when I was 13 and 14 and just had never gotten out of that rut. And, you know, meanwhile, the other people that maybe were partying with me back in my high school, you know, a lot of these people were like making something of themselves, like getting married and you know, getting good jobs and stuff and finishing college and going on to graduate, you know, whatever. And I was still, you know, still getting loaded, you know, and that was my day. And you know, there's so much dishonesty that I would tell myself because, I mean, I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous twice, you know, on two separate occasions when I would get locked up. And that was part of my probation was to, you know, get my paper signed and stuff like that. But I had no desire to stay sober or get sober, for that matter. I just wanted to stay out of jail. So I would comply with, you know, getting my paper signed and come to these rooms. But I sat in the back, you know, and I was probably drinking before or after the meeting. I don't know. But, I mean, I felt sorry for the people here, you know. Plus, my sister got sober by this point, and she was trying to plant the seed as well, trying to get me to come to some meetings and stuff. And I would come to her the birthday meetings and stuff, but, I mean, this wasn't for me. And I had to add to my story, you know. But anyway, getting back to the firm that I worked at, they really put up with a lot. And I came into work one day, and they said, you know, we need to see you in the conference room. And I was late that day, but I was not hungover. I only had one beer the night before. And why I remember that, I don't know. But that was my last beer. And that was on July 19th of 1993. And I remember when I went into the conference room, we had just been looking at some new copy machines. And this is how important I thought I was, that they wanted me to pick the one that we were going to have for the firm. I mean, hello. I mean, you know. But all the partners were sitting around the table. The administrator was sitting there. And some lady I didn't know was sitting there. I was thinking she was the office lady, you know, some kind of office, you know, copy machine lady or whatever. And I was going to make the final decision. But what happened was some intervention lady, you know. And I sat down and they said, you know, we think you have a drinking problem. Well, I never drank on the job, you know, because that's what an alcoholic does, and I wasn't one of those, you know. And I was just looking around, and I was kind of relieved in a way that it was out of the bag, because it's hard to keep up a facade of, you know, trying to wear a suit every day and high heels and stuff like that, and trying to, you know, making sure your shoes match and all that stuff, because sometimes they didn't. Sometimes the heels were even, you know, flat in a heel. I mean, come on. That's, you know. But they, you know, I was relieved, but yet I'm scared shitless, because I'm thinking, you know, how am I not supposed to do this? How can I not do this, you know? I mean, you think I'm choosing to live this way. I mean, I feel like crap, you know, 99% of the time because of my overdoing it every time when I tell myself I'm not going to overdo it. And I just don't seem to be able to get out of this rut that I kept thinking was a rut. And so I remember it was just such a dilemma, you know, get help or not. And I said, well, listen, you know, I hear what y'all are saying, but let me think about this a couple days. This is a lot for me to digest. And they said, I mean, if y'all ever watched that show, Intervention, they kind of push you in the corner, and you got to kind of give them an answer, like, right away. You know, you don't get a couple days. And so they just said, no, we need to know now. Either you go pack your desk up and everything's fine and you just go on your way, or we're going to hold your job for you. We've already got everything lined up for you. You go to treatment and do whatever. And I just really, I mean, I always say this, but it was like, okay, that's plan A and B, but I still want to see what is behind door number three. What's my C option? You know, and that's so alcoholic. I mean, it's you know, and, you know, I thought that was the worst day of my life. I'm thinking, man, how am I going to, you know, and I said, can I get some beer? If I go to treatment, can I get some beer on the way down? And they said, no, we're going to start this deal right away. So after much dilemma and stuff like that, I decided I'm going to go to treatment. And with the help of my sister's husband, it was his belly button birthday that day. And I remember calling him, and because I couldn't reach anybody else in the family. And I was like, you know, they think I have a drinking problem. What do you think I should do? And he's picked me up so many times from, you know, I couldn't even find my way to a parking lot sometimes. And he would say, you know, don't even drive. I mean, gosh, please, you know. So he was like, well, and he was very instrumental in that part of my, you know, getting help, was he just said, you know what, maybe you should go. And I was looking for him to say, well, let me come pick you up, and, you know, but he said, maybe you should go. And so I remember saying, all right, I'll go. And that proved to be one of the best days of my life, because it helped me to get the help that I needed, that I desperately needed, and I didn't even know I needed it. And I did a 30-day inpatient treatment, and after that, and I went to a wonderful place down in Statesboro. They got me off everything, and I started from scratch. They, you know, they didn't diagnose me as bipolar. They didn't diagnose me, even though I was batshit crazy, they didn't diagnose me with anything but just a good case of untreated alcoholism. And I'm so grateful for that, because now I have the playing field had been leveled, and now I have something to work with. Then, after I left there, I was scared to leave. I didn't want to be there when I first got there, but once it was time for me to be released and go home, then I'm, like, scared, because I'm like, okay, everything was kind of structured for me here, but when I leave and I live by myself, what's going to happen? I mean, what do I do? And I remember the best thing that they told me, that when I left, they said, when you leave here tonight, don't wait till tomorrow, because I'm a great procrastinator. Oh, I'll do it tomorrow. Tomorrow's another day. You know, that's another national anthem of ours. They said, you know, go to a meeting tonight. Don't wait. Don't wait. And I did. I went to a meeting that night, and I was scared. I was staying sober on fear. It was still very fresh in my mind, because, see, when I got sober, I was able to see myself as I really was for the first time. I mean, I'm talking the first time since I was 13, and I was 31. And I remember, like, day three or day four in treatment, I broke down. I mean, I just had a mental breakdown, because, I mean, I did not have anything that I could, I always call it Calgon, take me away. It's just that feeling, I needed something to take me out of me, and I didn't have that. And thank God I was in a lockdown place, because I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I was seeing reality, and I didn't like reality. It just sucked. And I felt like, you know, my insides had been just kind of turned open, and everything was just on raw, you know. But luckily they, you know, they worked with me, and I stayed sober. I was going to meetings. I was doing the deal. I mean, doing the deal, like not drinking and going to meetings. and for the first 10 months of my sobriety. I also had gone to an outpatient treatment back-to-back with that inpatient treatment once I got out of there, but I was able to go back to work. All was well for a while. Then the bottom falls out. My mom got sick with some heart problems, and I remember I was just, my nerves were just, I mean, you talk about a hamster wheel in the brain. I mean, I always equate it to silverware in a blender and you turn it on, and that's how my brain was 24/7. And things were getting on my nerves. I mean, I needed people to walk around on eggshells around me. Work was like, you know, what's going on with her? I mean, you know, the family life, you know, I wasn't married or anything, but I mean, my mom and dad were just like, you know, I remember going to my dad's birthday party down at the river, and it was like, it was supposed to be a really nice dinner down there, cookout and all this stuff, and I'm just complaining about my job. I mean, I was just complaining about everything. Everything was getting on my nerves. Traffic, sun, you know, the sun shining, the sun is not shining, or it's too bright, or it's too dark, or, I mean, you know, and the big book talks about that. We're constantly discontented, and, you know, and I just, you know, and I was restless, and I was very irritable, and little did I know, it was just, you know, part of my untreated alcoholism. See, what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous and what our big book tells us is that we have an illness that's really trifold. But I, you know, but it's, and I was, all I was doing was treating one part of my alcoholism. I wasn't drinking, you know, and that treats the physical part. See, if I drink and I'm an alcoholic, if I take one drink, and the big book always refers to that first drink. I used to hear people in meetings talk about that first drink. I'm like, well, what's wrong with these people? I mean, what is this first drink thing, man? It was never the first one that got me drunk. You know, I took pride in the fact that I could drink a lot, you know, when I was young. You know, when I'm older, it's not so much so pretty, you know, but it's that first one that triggers the allergy. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol once I put it in me. And so I was treating my physical part, but I still have this mental component that was not being treated. And I didn't understand that, you know. I wanted to blow my brains out at 10 months sober because I thought, okay, I'm coming to these meetings now. See, these meetings used to be really kind of cool, you know, when I first got sober. Oh, I love the people. They were, you know, they were just keep coming back, pat me on the back and stuff. So they were really cool meetings. But then at 10 months, I'm thinking, I hate these meetings. I hate these people that have a smile on their face. I hate these people that, you know, tell me to keep coming back. What do you mean keep coming back? For what? You know? And I mean, it was like I'm missing something here. I'm missing the secret handshake, or maybe I'm just so far gone. I don't know, you know. I mean, what is it, you know? And you know, because I equated my alcoholism with drinking, and I'm not drinking anymore, and my life was unraveling before my eyes, and I just didn't understand why. But it's because I was not treating the physical component. I mean, the mental component. So but the nice thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is people don't stand in my way of getting willing. And I was taught that from my sponsor. You never stand in someone's way of getting willing. And y'all just kept doing your deal and smiling and keep coming back. And I kept coming back. I don't know why, but there was something here I knew. I just didn't know how to tap into it. So, but they say when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I remember a little redheaded, freckled girl would start coming around these rooms, and I didn't like her, you know. I didn't like her much at all. And she would come with her husband, and she was always kind of happy. And, you know, she'd share in meetings. And when she would share in the meetings, though, I would listen because she had a. I liked what she had to say, but yet it made me uncomfortable because it was the truth. And I didn't really. I liked more of this touchy feely. Oh, you know, you'll be all right type thing, or this too shall pass. And I remember one time she came up to me and she says, "You know what? That's bullshit. It's not going to pass unless you do something." And I mean. I didn't like someone getting in my face like that, but yet I was intrigued by her because she was talking the truth. She had the cojones to come up and talk to me and tell me the truth. But the truth is painful sometimes. But anyway, the girl that I didn't like so much, she ended up being my sponsor. And I had a breakdown at work, and I remember this is before I had got her as my sponsor. And that's something in the big book that I really like is because it tells me that I don't have to really come to believe in anything except for one thing. It says I have to come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I've been living it. It says because when that happens, when I come to believe in that, that's when, you know, there was nothing left for me but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools that's going to be laid at my feet. And that's what happened with me. I remember, I mean, like I said, I'm not saying that for dramatics. I was going to kill myself because I thought if this is all there is to staying sober is not drinking and coming to these effing meetings, then screw this because I can't take it another minute. And I had exploded at work, which, like I always say, I always used to save that kind of behavior for my family, how lucky they were. But my emotional nature was just exploding everywhere. I could not control it. And that's something that our book talks about, too, is we cannot control our emotional nature. And because I didn't mean to be like that. I just couldn't help myself. And I remember I went to that meeting. I was bound and hell-bent on going out and getting drunk that night when that happened to me at work. But somehow I found myself at 8111. It's a club up in Dunwoody. And that girl that I didn't like so much, I remember she was there, and I asked her for help. And I said, will you be my sponsor? Can you help me? I didn't even know. I wasn't convinced that was going to help me. I just was convinced I was completely coming to believe in the hopelessness and futility of my life as I'd been living it. And she asked me if I was an alcoholic, and I was like, yeah. And she said, are you willing to go to any lengths to win victory over alcohol? And I said, yes, I am. I didn't know what that meant, but I better answer in the affirmative if she's going to help me. So she started giving me a series of directions to follow, and she said, she says, you're telling me you're willing, but you know what? You're an alcoholic, and I'm not going to really, believe too much of what you're telling me, but I'm going to believe through your actions. And she's taught me that action in Alcoholics Anonymous is the key word. And so I started following these directions, and I did them on a consistent basis. I didn't do them perfectly, but she would remind me when I wasn't, doing them perfectly. And I was so thin-skinned, I would just take it like, God, I'm a loser again, like, Chris Farley. But, she just kind of kept guiding me in the direction that I needed to be in. But the best thing she did was she got me into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, because I can't tell you if you're an alcoholic. You've got to diagnose yourself. And that's when I learned about the physical allergy and the mental obsession. And that's what the mental obsession was. And that's why I was so crazy, was because I was not treating that part. And this stuff started making sense to me. The book starts using words like insanity and illusion, delusion, obsession, all these things that are terms of dealing with the mind. And I started diagnosing myself as an alcoholic. And it scared me because I remember she said, get a pen or a pencil or a highlighter out and start identifying your own experience to what this book has to say. And I did. I started seeing myself in that book, and it scared me because in the first part of the book, there's a lot of gloom and doom. I'm thinking, shit, man, I can identify with this problem here, but I don't think this solution is going to be good enough for me. She says, just shut up and just do it. Just do what I'm telling you to do. And so once she saw that I was willing to go to lengths, that's when she took me through these steps. And she took me through the steps in one day. And I remember having this experience with her. I didn't know what I was doing, and I didn't have to know what I was doing. I just had to do what she told me to do. Again, following directions. And my whole life, I've never been a direction follower. I've been, a defiant girl. But the gift of desperation, that's why they call it a gift, is because it forced me into taking actions that I would not normally take. And, she took these steps with me. She didn't say, okay, figure it out. Here's the book. Go figure it out. She started, and we did some reading, and we did a lot of reading that day, but we did some reading, and the steps are all contained in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we took step one together, admitting I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. I pretty much had, done that by diagnosing myself, And it only makes sense if I'm admitting I don't have the power. I don't have the power to stay sober, but yet I don't have the power to resist a drink either. I don't have the power at all. And she told me to look up words, like power. Yeah, we hear this word all the time. Look up these words. Get a dictionary. And I had to get a child's dictionary because, I don't want to look up words that I have to look up. So I looked up the word power, and to simplify everything, it just means strength. I don't have the strength to do this by myself. I don't have the power. I don't have the strength. I could buy into that. So it tells me that if I don't have that, then I take step one. But then it says then I have to come to believe that a power can restore me to sanity, I think at the beginning that power greater than me was my sponsor until, I always say she's a surrogate until I could tap into the power that I found by taking these 12 steps. I did make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. Again, my sponsor was making my decisions for me, and the more I would turn into her, the more she would help me, and again, that was all before I had, so I was getting some practice on turning something over instead of turning it over in this mind that was just, the silverware and the blender, I couldn't figure out anything. And I was taught that once I make this decision, just like the big book says, this decision can have, you know, little permanent effect unless it's at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in myself that are blocking me off from this power I'm looking for. So I can remember when I first, you know, started coming around these rooms, I would always say, well, I'm on steps 1, 2, and 3. Well, you know what? There's no action with steps 1, 2, and 3. It's all internal. And the thing of it is, you know, my sponsor said any monkey can make a decision. But, you know, just if I decide to go out and get a job, it's still just deciding to get a job unless I follow it up with action. So it's the same thing with taking the rest of the steps. That's how I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, you know, is by taking the rest of these steps. I did my searching and fearless moral inventory, and I was so scared to do that because it's like I had been to meetings for 10 months and heard about the dreaded fourth step, and I was just petrified. And then, you know, I have to chuckle because, you know, I was in a room by myself with a pad and a pen and stuff I already knew. So all I had to do was get it from up here down on paper. Simple, you know. It's all these boogeyman fears that would just trip me up every time. So then I've completed my inventory, and I remember going to my sponsor saying, okay, I'm done. She says, all right. We did some more reading, and we got to the part in the book, and she says, you know, you don't have to do this with me if you don't want to. I didn't want to. Because I remember that first question for me was, what is the most shameful, disgusting thing you've ever done? And I didn't want to, I answered to the best of my knowledge on everything, on my four step at that time. It was just as honest as I could be. And I didn't want to let somebody else know this stuff. And for a split second, I was like, I'm out the door. I'm not telling you nothing. You know, I'm going to call the operator, you know, let her know, or, you know, something. But I, you know, I cannot be face to face and tell somebody this stuff. And but you know what, I said to myself, Liz, who are you kidding? If you don't do it with her, who are you kidding? You're not going to do it with anybody. So I remember I sat down and I remember I was kind of hee-hawing around. And I said, well, I'm afraid if I tell you these things, you're not going to really like me too much. And she goes, well, I really don't care for you too much anyway, so just go ahead and get on with it. And I said, well, I'm afraid if I tell you these things that, you know, you're going to tell everybody this stuff. And she goes, well, believe it or not, Liz, and that's how self-centered I was. I didn't even realize it. She says, believe it or not, I talk about other things that, you know, other than you. And, you know, I mean, I thought my stuff was so important. Well, so she was shooting down all my excuses, and I went ahead and revealed the big reveal. And she's, you know, she's listening and yawning through some of it, you know, and I'm just like, you know. But once I got that first question out and the first answer out, I was fine. And I got all that stuff out, and it was almost like verbal diarrhea. I was just getting it all out, and I remember when I finished the fifth step, she says, well, how do you feel? And I said, I don't know. I mean, it was a good feeling, but I couldn't describe it. And she said, you know, I said, I feel empty, but not like I needed to fill it back up with something. She goes, that's peace, you know. And it was a wonderful thing to feel. We were sitting on a roof of her house. I know it sounds crazy, but we were smoking and stuff. That's when I smoked cigarettes, and we were at her mom's, and we were allowed to smoke inside. So, I mean, it was a really cool experience. Then we went into step six, and I asked, I became entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. She was pointing out she was highlighting my character defects as I was giving her, you know, my fourth step, fifth step, whatever, and just kind of letting me see how all these things had just, you know, really screwed up my life, you know. Just like the book says, self-manifested in various ways is what had defeated me. All those years, and I kept blaming it on you guys, not you specifically, but, you know, the world, you know, if people just treat me different, or if you know, and you know, or treat me kinder, or don't they know how I feel, or stuff like that, and you know, it wasn't y'all, it was the way I perceived the world. And so then in step seven, I humbly asked God to remove my shortcomings. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, a magic wand was waved over me and poof, I'm a new creation. I became a new creation when I decided, you know, made that decision to turn my life and my will over to God, and to follow it up with all the rest of these actions. But what happens is, and God is the one that deems what character defects are he's going to take and what he's going to leave me. Like I said, I always thought it was a character defect of mine to be so shy. But you know what? That's where I totally rely on God, you know. So he's not going to remove that one from me, you know. And I'm grateful for that because, like I said, I'm total God-reliant in that area. When I don't need God, it's like, you know, I mean, what would be the point, then, of, you know, a spiritual connection with him? So the character defects that I, you know, that I know that he's removed a lot of my selfishness, but I still am plagued by a lot of my selfishness, you know. But at least I am aware now, you know. I tell the people that I sponsor, it's kind of like doing the dishes in the day, you know, during the day. I may do the dishes in the morning and for breakfast, you know, after breakfast, you know, and get that sink clean. But the thing of it is, by the end of the night, you know, there's more dishes in that sink, and that's what my 10th step is for. But I'll get to that in a minute. Step 8, my sponsor made a list of all people I had harmed and became and I had to become willing to make amends to these people. She made that list when she was listening to me do my fifth step, and she was writing it. She wrote it from easiest to hardest, and it was a pretty short list, but, you know, there was some family on there, some past employers that I'd stolen from and stuff like that, some neighbors and stuff. But I went out, I remember, and made those amends, and kind of got slack on the harder ones. But I did go out and make those, and man, what a freedom, especially with the harder ones, you know, just like the big book says, you know, we find it, you know, there's so much more benefit from doing that. And I just felt like I was just taking a lot more out of self and making a lot more room for God in there. Step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. The book tells me that I do this for a lifetime. It doesn't, and it tells me that I vigorously commence this way of living as I clean up the past. So my sponsor said, okay, tomorrow you start doing a written 10th step. You do a written inventory, you know, because I don't want this stuff to pile up again, just like the sink, you know, the dirty dishes in the sink. Just because I cleaned them once doesn't mean they're not going to pile up again. And so I haven't found it necessary to do another 4th step since I've taken, you know, the steps, because I stay current. What happens is I got myself current by doing the 4th step. And the way I keep current, though, is by doing the 10th step. And, you know, and the questions that I answer on page 84, excuse me, 86 in the book, and it doesn't take very long. In fact, when I'm going to bed at night, my husband says, you're sitting in your office, and I'm usually writing, you know. So then it says, I sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And, you know, I pray, you know, and the Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to pray. I was raised in the church, and I'm grateful for that. But I've sponsored many people that have not been a member of a church before they got here. I've gone back to the church that I left many years ago when I was in my heyday. Prayer is very important to me, and it's really neat when we do it as a family. I know that sometimes my little girl will come and kneel down. She's 8, and she'll come and she'll see me kneeling down. And she'll come and kneel down with me too, and my husband will sometimes too. And it's just a powerful thing. But that's part of my maintenance, and to improve my conscious contact with God. You know, that's where my addiction, or not my addiction, but my need for more is to my benefit, because I want more of what I have, and the only way I can do that is by continue to take these actions. Then it tells me on step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I know I've had a spiritual awakening. I know that that the girl that I was, you know, years ago, at least, you know, 14 years ago, I feel like I'm a new creature, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life in more ways than one. It's helped me to not drink, and it's helped me to not think, which is a true miracle. I still think, but it's that obsessiveness that just can drive me crazy. And I can still get very obsessive, but these actions help to kind of keep that at bay, you know, as long as I continue to treat my alcoholism. And to kind of go back to the improving my conscious contact with God, God sometimes will tap me on the shoulder, and he'll present something to me that he wants me to work on. And he's helped me to quit smoking. I quit smoking like 4 years after I got sober, and I swore I would never give up those cigarettes. I swore I would never. But again, I mean, I will not give up anything until it's damn near ready to kill me. And God took those away from me. I didn't do it with the patch. I did it through just cold turkey and a lot of praying. Also, 2 years ago, God was tapping me on the shoulder about some weight issues, and I was just very obese, and God said, you know, you're going to get drunk if you don't do something with this. And I needed to either see what this program provides for me is a daily reprieve. And my reprieve was running out. I had to look up the word reprieve, and it's a postponement of a death sentence. And I know that the illness of alcoholism, for me, it can manifest itself in so many different ways. I kind of look at the illness of alcoholism like a tree, and there's so many different branches of my alcoholism because I used to eat like I drank, I used to smoke like I drank, I used to do drugs like I drank. But the cool thing of it is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous can address any problem if I just turn it in, you know, to surrender it. And like I said, as a result, I was able to take off 150 pounds by what God has done for me. But I have to practice these principles in all my affairs. And believe me, I am not perfect at this by any means of the imagination. My husband even told me tonight, I'm so glad you're not perfect, you know. And I don't strive to be today. That was one thing that I always wanted to keep up a facade of perfection. And I put such high standards, but I could never reach them. They were always just so out of reach. And then, so then, the other end of that spectrum is, screw it. Why do I even try at all? You know? So, you know, I was a pretty sick puppy, and I still can be, but through the practicing of these principles, and by, you know, just staying ingrained in meetings and sponsoring people. I love the people I sponsor. I mean, they're just so dear to me, and you know, my family. I wouldn't have any of this if I wasn't sober. And like I said, though, God taps me on the shoulder and he says, okay, this is what we're going to do. You're at a crossroads. You're either going to surrender X, Y, and Z, or you're going to get drunk again. See, everything hinges on my sobriety. If I'm not sober, I don't have anything else. But that's when people will say the road does get narrower. And that's how it has been for me. And it's getting rid of resentments, getting rid of, you know, anything that blocks me off from God. Because that's what the book says, is that God is deep down within every one of us. And I truly believe that. And that's helped me with people I resent. That's helped me with people I get angry at. I ask God, one of my prayers is, God, help me to see you in them instead of seeing them. I mean, that helps me. I mean, truly. And because I can't say that he's in me and not in you. So I'm grateful. I know it's after 9, and I know we've got some chips to give out tonight. So I just want to thank Tim for having me speak tonight. And don't call me Machine Gun Liz. But anyway, thank you, and Happy New Year to everybody. And you guys have a fun, safe holiday tonight, and have a blessed New Year in 2008. Thank you.